It's the only time they put it this way. And they talk about man's will in relation to the Father's will. And of course, if we didn't have free will, they couldn't exactly refer to it. They say this choosing of the Father's will is the spiritual finding of the Spirit Father by mortal man, even though an age must pass before the creature son may actually stand in the factual presence of God on paradise. This choosing does not so much consist in the negation of creature will, not my will but yours be done, as it consists in the creature's positive affirmation, it is my will that your will be done.
That's so much better. Mm-hmm. And truer.
Yes.
It is my cable.
You're putting your cable.
Ernie?
It seems to me that a lot of this creature paradox, this human paradox, can be resolved if you are pretty certain about God. If you're sure about God and you're sure about his love, and if you've got enough maturity to not presume on him, just trust him, I think in the child-father relationship you have your best cure for the human paradox. You know you're a creature, you're of a different order of being. You're not his equal, you're merely made partly in his image. And you keep things in proportion that way. Shoot.
May I offer this as a very slight contradiction? You're going to shoot full of holes on page 381, the third paragraph, the first couple of sentences. I think this is the thing we're fighting. I think this is the...
The dual nature of man. And the fact that we can't, a mammal and a thought adjuster have nothing in common. And that man is caught in the middle. Because human nature impinges on both mammalian nature and the indwelling spirit indirectly. But again, so we're mammals. So we have a spiritual potential. I don't know, it seems to me that people tend to move in one of two directions. Either they sort of give up on the spiritual side and just enjoy being mammalian. And I'm afraid a lot of people are simply responding to the simple mammalian urge to live. Or they get real persnickety on the other side and sort of in the fashion of, who was it, founded the Methodist Church?
Wesley.
Yeah, they attempt sainthood in this life. And I think in attempting sainthood in this life, you're going to warp like a pretzel. I mean, I just think you wind up as some sort of a monster because you're trying to be a frog and you're not a frog, you're a tadpole. And I'm a little bit thick, but I don't quite see why all of this noise and shouting about this. Because I feel cheerful about being a mammal, I feel hopeful about being a phenalator, and I know I'm in the middle. And both ends are playing me in the middle, and I laugh about it, and I can't get too excited about this.
But Paul, the Apostle Paul, started people thinking about the difficulties of...
Of course the Apostle Paul did, but that's not the teachings of Jesus.
Oh, no, but that's...
I know.
Where it came from, I think. And where the Christian church got that emphasis.
I do not personally see this problem in my own life. Maybe I'm blind. I know I'm a mammal. Comparative anatomy has convinced me of this. I did some dissection once upon a time. And I feel a kinship with God. And the paradox to me is divinely humorous. It's funny. It's not tragic. It's just plain darn funny. I can chuckle at this paradox.
It's also a fascinating bill.
Yes, it is.
Well, I think it's thrilling.
I mean, there is so much. I see this in myself and I see it in my fellow men. There is so much that's great and grand and noble in humanity, and so much that's just plain damn foolishness. And it's such an interesting mixed drink. This is not bottled in bond. This is a very complicated drink. It's like a pousscafe. I understand there are people who actually drink such things.
I thought we kind of halfway resolved that problem yesterday when we looked at the quotation on 383.
Yes.
Just the next one. Next page. I mean, I had thought that all. They're not in conflict with even the highest spiritual attainment, except in the minds of ignorant mistaught or unfortunately over conscientious persons.
I think some people set up standards which are unrealistic. And I think people confuse mores with morals. A student of history, even a casual student of history, is bound to develop a certain sophistication in his attitude toward mores, or the customs of whatever tribe in which one chances to live. I happen to live in a Midwestern American tribe. We have our mores. And the different times and places provide different standards of conduct. And feelings of guilt arise psychologically through a transgression of the mores. And this does not necessarily mean the guilt that attaches to sin, which the paper specifically defines as conscious disloyalty to deity. But you feel uneasy if you run counter to the mores of your time and place, if you believe in these mores. That's partly what we're up against here. But it's still true, we're slothful. I'm not so concerned about the, quote, lusts of the flesh, unquote. And the word lust meant something quite different when it was used in the translation. It meant desire. You know what I mean? It's come to have a quite sinister meaning. I believe the word homely is applied to a woman. It meant literally homelike. But since all gals want to be femme fatales, the word homely fell into disrepute quite quickly. Who wants to be a home-like gal? Everybody wants to be a glamour gal. I just think people set up standards that are unrealistic and then fail. They take an ideal and presume that it's an idea when it's not. An idea is a validated plan for action. You can execute an idea. An ideal is something yet again. It cannot be executed until it has been translated and promoted to the level of an idea. Up until that time, it's merely a dream about a plan for action. It's something which may stimulate conduct, but it cannot guide conduct. And I think if we will get our ideals to the level of ideas, then these we can execute. You cannot execute an ideal exactly. You can attempt it, but you're going to fail. And this, I think, is where we say, well, gee, we're falling down. Mea culpa, bring on the sackcloth and ashes. I don't think this is realistic living. Here, I think there is a possibility of developing from this blue book a religion the like of which this world has never yet seen. A religion that's full of good humor. A religion which is full of the joy of existence. A religion which is totally devoid of fear on the theological or spiritual nature. A religion which people wear casually and yet earnestly. A religion which is gracious in its tolerance, in its leashed strength. A religion which has nothing to do with any one day of a week. A religion which pervades the whole of a human life, 24 hours a day. A religion which is dealt with in a familiar, friendly way. A religion which is a part of a human being. A religion which is inseparable from philosophy, from ethics, from morality, from economics, from political thinking, and everything else. A religion which seeps down through all the levels of a human personality until it becomes indistinguishable from the whole social fragrance of that human being. This to me is religion which appeals. And this to me is a religion which you don't find very much of in human history. You remember in this government on a neighboring planet? They don't have any churches at all. Here's a world that's evolved to the point where it's ahead of us, at least socially, economically, and politically. No church has yet appeared in that society. That intrigues me. That intrigues me. What do you think about this idea of religion? This is a religion which you're good-natured about. This is a religion where you don't pick it up gingerly, you know. You breathe it like you breathe air. You drink it like you drink water. It's a normal part of living. It's real. It's not something that's dissociated, compartmentalized, or set off. It's something which it's so much a part of your life that you're casual with it. It's a familiar thing. You're casual with it like you're casual with clothing that's well broken in, an old suit of tweeds. It's a friendly, familiar, warm thing. It's nothing which you feel either ashamed of or heroic about. It's something which you just are. Yes, yes. And you have convictions along with tolerance. One of the most shameful things about Christianity is its intolerance. I think if it hadn't been for the Blue Book, I don't know. I might have been a Mahayana Buddhist. Because the intolerance of Christianity is to me a terribly repelling thing. I'd have missed Jesus, but I would have gotten a religion which is broad and tolerant.
What did they say about the Orientals think Christianity is a strange religion?
For white men?
For strangers.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
A strange religion.
I think Harry Emerson Fosdy has kind of approached that attitude, except not quite so casual.
Mm-hmm. He can't. He's a reverend.
But a good deal the same.
Here's the thought about religion. Can we have religion without a priesthood?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I think I am about one of the most unbishop-like persons ever to become connected with a religious movement. I am absolutely a layman. Anything other than that thought is repulsive to me. Can we have a thing like this without having priests and ministers? Jesus started out with a bunch of fishermen.
He was a layman.
And there wasn't a single one of the apostles was a graduate of a theological seminary. Is it possible that we could do this with the Blue Book business? Or if we've got to have something, could we at least be as wise as they were in the Commonwealth of Israel when they required that each rabbi learn a trade? Paul was a tent maker by profession. At least this keeps the rabbi in touch with reality, you know? The few ministers I've met that really appeal to me, well, more than half of them had this quality. They entered the ministry late in life after having been very successful businessmen. And there was something very real about these guys. I met an Episcopalian priest in Hudson, Ohio, who had been a hoingding of an insurance agent and entered the ministry at age 40. I met him when he was 50. Gee, the guy talked real, you know. Yes.
How about the Quakers and the Christian Scientists? They have been priests.
That's true.
But they're not facing, the Christian Scientists aren't facing reality.
That's for sure.
Well, they're like Buddhists.
Yes, exactly. Christian Science is very similar to Buddhism.
I don't see why Quakers wouldn't be enthusiastic about this book.
People should be enthusiastic about this book, regardless of what they are. I mean,
but the teaching about the guidance of the inner spirit ought to make Quakers open to it, but the couple of them I've met aren't.
The biggest thing that impresses me about this, about what they say about sectarianism, is that it has ignored God, and now they're going out to defy Him and start a war against Him. They've got.
Secularism.
Secularism. If they started out ignoring God in their fight against church-state control.
Ecclesiastical totalitarianism, right, was what they were trying to destroy.
And I don't see how anyone of any that really believes closely and follows any secular religion could call for this, because of the fact that this teaches you friendship with God.
What do you mean by secular religion?
Well, any religion that is, well, any religion that claims it will bring forth the brotherhood of man our way is a secular religion, right?
Yeah, the communism. Communism is attempting to have heaven on earth. That's their ideology. That's not their practice, but that's their teaching. It's the worship of man.
Yeah. Humanism.
Yes.
Any ism that thinks they got it and no one else does is secular.
Well, sectarian.
Oh, I wouldn't call that.
I would say that's sectarian.
Oh,
sectarian.
Yeah. Churches? Well, that's totally different.
Well?
Secularism and sectarianism.
Yeah, okay. I'm malapproving again.
Well.
Yeah.
Can we return?
I understand now. I withdraw my question.
I withdraw my answer.
Could we
motion before the house?
Could we return to personality again? What do you say we have a little full dress discussion on personality and see a bit about what the book says about it? Let's start out with page 1225. It's appropriate to our rambling discussion this afternoon. As a backdrop for this study, somewhere in these papers it says that personality is one of the unsolved mysteries of the universe of universes. So I think appropriately they say it would be presumptuous to attempt the definition of personality. But still we can describe what personality does. We can tell what we know about it. I looked up personality in Webster. It's defined as the quality or state of being personal. It's a beautiful definition, isn't it? It starts out by saying, personality is that quality in reality which is bestowed by the Universal Father himself or by the conjoint actor acting for the Father. Well, let's explore now and see what that means. Let's look over on page 106. This is a key to many things in the papers, this little inventory. Down in near the, just below the middle of the page, it says, the Father bestows personality by his personal free will. Why he does so, we can only conjecture. How he does so, we do not know. Neither do we know why the third source bestows non-Father personality. But this the Infinite Spirit does in his own behalf, in creative conjunction with the Eternal Son, and in numerous ways unknown to you. The Infinite Spirit can also act for the Father in the bestowal of First Source personality. So that a being who is in the Father's personality circuit may have received this personality by the act of the Universal Father, or he may have received this personality by the act of the Infinite Spirit acting as attorney in fact for the Universal Father. That's what that statement means. Now let's take a little excursion. We hit something in here that's intriguing. There are two kinds of personalities. If it is a Father bestowed personality, it's called First Source personality. But there are third source personalities, beings who have free will but are not in the Father's personality circuit. You see, the Infinite Spirit can not only draw sight drafts on the Father's account, but he can issue checks in his own name and write. And then these are third source personalities. And they're defined in here. They have subjective self-consciousness, but they do not objectively respond to the Father's personality circuit.
Are you on 103?
Yeah, 106. They may not be unqualifiedly personal to creature beings, but they are contactable. All personality is contactable. There are numerous types of third source personalities. The Infinite Spirit bestows third source personality upon numerous groups who are not included in the Father's personality circuit, such as certain of the power directors. I'm sure that the, I'm sure these power centers are volitionally intelligent beings. I know that the associate power directors are personal beings in the third source sense. Now below that level, I don't think they have free will in the third source sense. So our first statement here, personality is that quality in reality which is bestowed by the Universal Father himself or by the conjoint actor acting for the Father. This discussion has to do with first source personality. They're ignoring third source personality because they're talking about us. Two, it may be bestowed upon any living energy system which includes mind or spirit. Now let's think about that. The use of the word or means it could be bestowed upon a living energy system which was wholly non-spiritual. Well, let's see what the papers say about that. Okay. Over on page 334, I think it's fun to take this list and use it as an index, because these statements are very cryptic. In the second full paragraph on page 334, it says, "We may, however, state that there are no personalities of pure mind. No entity has personality unless he is endowed with it by God, who is spirit. Any mind entity that is not associated with either spiritual or physical energy is not a personality." That's either or. And then down at the bottom of the page, "Certain other unrevealed creatures are what might be termed mindal and physical energy personalities. This type of being is non-responsive to spirit gravity, but is nonetheless a true personality. It is within the Father's circuit. We know nothing of such beings." These beings could be moral beings, because morality is an attribute of personality. So we can say, item two means, you could have a being whose constituent components were physical and mindal. That could be a personal being. You could have a being whose constituents were physical, mindal, and spiritual, as us, who could be a personal being. You could have a being consisting of an association of mind and spirit in varying percentages. Some more mindal with spirit, others more spiritual with mind, and these could be personal. Or you could have a being who was wholly spiritual, and this could be a personal being. Can we think of any being who is wholly spiritual and who is a personality? Yes, the Eternal Son. Stop and think. Neither the Father nor the Son have mind, because there is no mind until you get to the third source and center. No being antecedent to the third source and center is minded. It has mind as we understand mind. We'll come to this in a second.
Bill, can I interrupt you a second? The Father does not have mind.
Yes.
On page 365, there's a statement that says there is in the mind of God.
They're using that figuratively.
Just using it figuratively.
Yes. A thought adjuster doesn't have mind, but a thought adjuster is minded. We'll come to this in just a minute. Three, personality is not wholly subject to the fetters of antecedent causation. It is relatively creative or co-creative.
And co-creative is so marvelous, I think.
Yes, with the adjuster.
By me, the soul.
In other words, here is a series. And the mathematical prediction of the outworking of this series of events is computable. But when you inject a personality into this picture, you inject a random element, and the result is not strictly computable. Let's see if I can find something on that subject. Yes, on page 70, it's what I was looking for. Personality is one of the unsolved mysteries of the universe of universes. We are able to form adequate concepts of the factors entering into the makeup of various orders and levels of personality, but we do not fully comprehend the real nature of the personality itself. Yes. Capacity for divine personality is inherent in the pre-personal adjuster. Capacity for human personality is potential in the cosmic mind endowment of the human being. But the experiential personality of mortal man is not observable as an active and functional reality until after the material life vehicle of the mortal creature has been touched by the liberating divinity of the Universal Father, being thus launched upon the seas of experience as a self-conscious and a relatively self-determinative and self-creative personality. The material self is truly and unqualifiedly personal. It's that creativity that constitutes free will. Because out of this series of events, a personality may, at any decision juncture, create something that is not wholly predictable by antecedent causation. He may react in some new way, some non-predictable way, or some only partially predictable way. Determinism is in the keyboard of the piano. The free will is exhibited when the musician, with those keys, produces the melodies which come from somewhere. That's creativity, and that's free will. The musician cannot transcend the keyboard, but within the limits of that keyboard, what can't he do? We have 26 letters in the alphabet, and consider what William Shakespeare did with those 26 letters. That's creativity, and creativity, in the very word creativity, implies freedom of action, some degree of freedom from antecedent causation.
Within the limits of.
Yes, right. Our good friend had only 7 colors in the chromatic scale to work with and what he could see. But there's creativity in that picture. Within the limits of the canvas and the color, he had freedom to record his impression. And no two artists would make the same recording. But two color cameras, would take identical photographs. And there's the difference. Bud and I could set up 2 color cameras, take that picture, and the difference would be predictable in the nature of the camera and the nature of the film. But if he and I could both paint, we'd sit down and we'd come out with 2 different pictures. And there's the difference. The camera has no freedom of choice. Number 4. When bestowed upon evolutionary material creatures, it causes spirit to strive for the mastery of energy matter through the mediation of mind. And here we've come to one of the great fundamentals in these papers. In the time-space universes, energy-matter is dominant, save in personality, where spirit, through the mediation of mind, is striving for the master. And I think that that principle explains a whole heck of a lot of what's going on out here in time and space. This is a reflection of the whole evolution of the Supreme Being on the deity level, and of human progression, of the paradise ascension on the human level. Spirit can't touch matter. Mind can. And a personality can subordinate that mind which dominates matter to that spirit which must stabilize mind. That the personality can do by free will choice. Number 5, personality, while devoid of identity, can unify the identity of any living energy system. It dominates the system. It is the yellow of the material object we were talking about. It pervades the whole of that system. It's dependent on the living mechanism for expression, but it expresses itself by dominating the entire system. And again, I would go back to the string and the beads. Personality takes an agglomeration of beads and produces a necklace. Personality patternizes such a system. Six, personality discloses only qualitative response to the personality circuit in contradistinction to the three energies which show both qualitative and quantitative response to gravity. And that's why the personality circuit is non-computable, as we observed over in the paper on the universe of universes. It's on page 133, paragraph 3. Personality gravity is non-computable. We recognize the circuit, but we cannot measure either qualitative or quantitative realities responsive thereto. There is no mass to personality, but there is mass to mind. There's mass in matter. There's spiritual mass. The drawing power of the eternal sun apparently grows greater as we near paradise, because we are becoming more spiritual, hence more massive at the spiritual level, and our mass is more responsive to spiritual gravity. But the Father's drawing power in the personality circuit is just as strong out here as it is anywhere. It's independent of distance, and there is no mass to vary. Seven, personality is changeless in the presence of change. Let's see if we can find something on that. It's in here, and I'm not too darn sure where it is. Somewhere, and I think it's in the adjuster papers. It points out that the personality never does change, and if it did, it wouldn't be you anymore. And the thing that does change is your growing soul. No, I won't find it. Eight. Personality can make a gift to God, the dedication of the free will to the doing of the will of God. And I think it's the only thing we can give God. The only possible gift. And actually, this is an expression of love in the final analysis. If you really love God, Holy Toledo, you want to do what he wants.
What wouldn't you do for him?
Well, sure. You want to do what he wants. This is no chore. This is a delightful and romantic adventure in living in an exciting way. This is no hair shirt that you wear, you know, in self-ostentatious righteousness. This is no manifestation of piousity. This may result in unconscious piety. Gee whiz, just imagine Jesus saying, when they called him good, "Why do you call me good?" This is real piety. He wasn't thinking about being good. He wasn't standing in front of the mirror of his mind in self-admiration saying, "I'm really good." You know? Nine, personality is characterized by morality. Awareness of relativity of relationship with other persons. It discerns conduct levels and choosingly discriminates between them. We can find something in the papers on that. If you want, are you making notes of these?
Yeah.
All right, start with page 191 and just put down FF, meaning the following pages, the whole rest of the paper.
For this particular 191.
Discussing morality. That's in the tail end, the second half of the paper on the seven master spirits, where they start with cosmic mind, and in the next section, they discuss morals, virtue, and personality. This paper in here is the third full dress discussion of personality in the papers. Intelligence alone cannot explain the moral nature. Morality, virtue, is indigenous to human personality. Moral intuition, the realization of duty, is a component of human mind endowment and is associated with the other inalienables of human nature, scientific curiosity and spiritual insight. Man's mentality far transcends that of his animal cousins, but it is his moral and religious natures that especially distinguish him from the animal world. And then they point out the true nature of morality, that an animal discriminates, but he discriminates only means, whereas man can discriminate ends. And this moral capacity in human nature enables man to have prophetic vision. He can examine an end of a course of conduct, and he can respond to the stimulus of potential evil. He can choosingly discriminate a better course of conduct without actually involving himself in the evil of a less desirable course of conduct. It is because of this that actual evil does not have to appear in time and space. Potential evil must appear, but we can respond, we can take a look at a situation and say, not for me. We make our decision not based on traversing the route, but based on a prior examination of that route. We say too many detours. Animals learn ordinarily only from leaping. Humans can learn from looking as well as from leaping. I'll cheerfully concede most of us learn like the animals do from leaping, but we could learn from looking. This paper goes on, it discusses Urantia personality.
Are you back on 1225?
No, I'm sticking on 194. This is a gold mine in here.
Oh, one, I need to, I've got mine all marked up.
On 194, we tie in to statement 10. Personality is unique, absolutely unique. It is unique in time and space. It is unique in eternity and on paradise. It is unique when bestowed. There are no duplicates. It is unique during every moment of existence. It is unique in relation to God. He is no respecter of persons. but neither does he add them together. For they are non-addable. They are associable, but non-totalable.
Denies quantity, but verifies quality.
That's right.
Pumps up my four tires, too.
Yes. Let's read over on page 194 what it says about that. Starting in paragraph 2, personality is a unique endowment of original nature, whose existence is independent of and antecedent to the bestowal of the thought adjusters. Nevertheless, the presence of the adjuster does augment the qualitative manifestation of personality. Thought adjusters, when they come forth from the Father, are identical in nature. But personality is diverse, original, and exclusive. And the manifestation of personality is further conditioned and qualified by the nature and quantities of the associated energies of a material, mental, and spiritual nature, which constitute the organismal vehicle for personality manifestation. Personalities may be similar, but they are never the same. Persons of a given series, type, order, or pattern may and do resemble one another, but they are never identical. Personality is that feature of an individual which we know and which enables us to identify such a being at some future time, regardless of the nature and extent of changes in form, mind, or spirit status. Personality is that part of an individual which enables us to recognize and positively identify that person as the one we have previously known, no matter how much he may have changed, because of the modification of the vehicle of expression and manifestation of his personality. Yellow is yellow. And no matter how he changes in shape, he's still the same hue. And it's the hue that we recognize as him. You see, personality is irreplaceable. Utterly irreplaceable. Now let's consider that.
Our contribution to the Supreme?
It's partly here. The great challenge that has been given to mortal man is this.
What page, Bill?
1284. Will you decide to personalize the experienceable value meanings of the cosmos into your own evolving selfhood? Or by rejecting survival, will you allow these secrets of supremacy to lie dormant, awaiting the action of another creature at some other time who will, in his way, attempt a creature contribution to the evolution of the finite God? But that will be his contribution to the Supreme, not yours. The great struggle in this universe age is between the potential and the actual, the seeking for actualization by all that is as yet unexpressed. If mortal man proceeds upon the paradise adventure, he's following the motions of time which flow as currents within the stream of eternity. If mortal man rejects the eternal career, he is moving counter to the stream of events in the finite universe. The mechanical creation moves on inexorably in accordance with the unfolding purpose of the Paradise Father, but the volitional creation has the choice of accepting or rejecting the role of personality participation in the adventure of eternity. Mortal man cannot destroy the supreme values of human existence, but he can very definitely prevent the evolution of these values in his own personal experience, to the extent that the human self thus refuses to take part in the paradise ascent. To just that extent is the supreme delayed in achieving divinity expression in the grand universe. Into the keeping of mortal man has been given not only the adjuster presence of the Paradise Father, but also control over the destiny of an infinitesimal fraction of the future of the Supreme. For as man attains human destiny, so does the Supreme achieve destiny on deity levels. And so the decision awaits each of you, as it once awaited each of us. Will you fail the God of time, who is so dependent upon the decisions of the finite mind? This is cosmic morality. Will you fail the supreme personality of the universes by the slothfulness of animalistic retrogression? Will you fail the great brother of all creatures who is so dependent on each creature? Can you allow yourself to pass into the realm of the unrealized when before you lies the enchanting vista of the universe career, the divine discovery of the Paradise Father, and the divine participation in the search for and evolution of the God of Supremacy? God's gifts, his bestowal of reality, are not divorcements from himself. He does not alienate creation from himself. But he has set up tensions in the creation's circling paradise. God first loves man and confers upon him the potential of immortality, eternal reality. And as man loves God, so does man become eternal in actuality. And here is mystery. The more closely man approaches God through love, the greater the reality, actuality of that man. The more man withdraws from God, the more nearly he approaches non-reality, cessation of existence. When man consecrates his will to the doing of the Father's will, when man gives God all that he has, then does God make that man more than he is.
Just a bit. God makes that man more than he is.
More than that man
That's
is.
That's when he gives the spiritual strength to grow.
That's when you grow. Your soul grows. Then you become a little less animal, a little more human, and in time, a little more spiritual. This is how man becomes a finaliter. And a finaliter is a great deal more than a human being. That's how, yes.
If we get to the simple thesis of just choosing, how could anyone choose cessation?
I don't know.
I can't comprehend at all. It seems
it's evidently possible.
There are two choices, cessation or God's way. Well, how could anyone choose?
I'll tell you, Julia, how it could be done. The thing can happen because of the slothfulness of animalistic retrogression. I don't think any human being ever would choose not to survive. But I think a human being might start a series of choices. In each instance, choosing the easy way, the lower way, and eventually the cumulative effect of those choices would make it impossible for him to stop the momentum of choice.
Doesn't it say that sometimes?
Yes, yes.
I can imagine a person just not wanting to climb the steep hill.
Well, yeah, not if they're waiting cessation.
As you, just the acts of today are the destiny of tomorrow. Mm-hmm. As you choose, so do you become.
Bill, you're in your early life, you were raised out of any church, right?
Yes.
Without any religious training whatsoever?
No, I had religious training.
Oh.
I got it from my mother.
Oh.
I knew the sheiks of Israel.
Okay.
The judges, pardon me, but they were sheiks.
I was going to say that if someone was raised without any religious training whatsoever, without any concept of a first cause or God, then they couldn't really make a choice until they had a concept.
I don't know.
To choose.
They got a thought adjuster.
That's right.
I had no religious training whatsoever.
You
know, I mean, they mentioned God occasionally, but I had no training.
I'll tell you this, Bun.
How about moral?
The training which I had was
yes.
Bible training.
Right.
And it was at a very childish level. We never got into the Bible per se. I had something called a child's book of the Bible with woodcuts in it. And when I was 17, I was in the service, and I woke up to the fact that I was a real agnostic. The anthropomorphic picture I had of God was a white-bearded version of my old man, king size. And just like the proofs that you get from a photographer, you know, the red ones, this thing had faded out imperceptibly. And when I got the old picture out, it was blank. I never had any struggle. My anthropomorphic guide, God, just faded on me. It was gone. And I got interested in the whole idea, listening to a debate in the barracks between a real sharp atheistic friend of mine and a fairly dumb Catholic. And the atheist won the debate. But I was very conscious of the fact that he won it because he was far more clever. He could twist the Catholic in knots. And my Catholic buddy blew his stack and in a very profane and vulgar way said that the priest could prove there was a God, and my atheist friend with equal profanity said he couldn't. And my Catholic friend, with still more profanity, allowed as how this could be arranged. And my atheist friend took him up, and I spoke for the first time. I said, I want to come along. Because it suddenly hit me that it was very important to listen to this debate. And that, of course, was a draw. I was very impressed with the fact that Jerry couldn't prove there wasn't a God, and old Father Murdoch couldn't prove that there was. And I set about thinking. And I used to have a girl in Georgetown. When I took her home, I had a lot of time to kill because by that time I'd missed all the trains for Quantico. The next one was at 3:15 in the morning. And I used to go to a place which I now think of as my church. My church is the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington. And I'd roll Bull Durham cigarettes. I've sat there during cherry blossoms, and I've sat there when it was snowing, and I've sat there when it was darned hot and darned cold. And I would meditate, looking at the Washington Monument and the Dome of the Capitol and the moon and the stars and old Abe sitting up there in the shadow. And somewhere along at that time, I came to the realization that there was a God. I symbolized him in my thinking with a rather peculiar name. I called him the Great Source and Center. I put that in writing so that I know I'm not reading that back into the thing. And I became just as certain about him as I am today. And that's before I read any of this blue book business. And this became a settled thing, like dried apples and rainwater, and you use bricks for construction in some buildings, and gravity, and 2 and 2 is 4. I mean, this didn't strike me as being any particular unusual discovery. It was like suddenly realizing that you're breathing, you know? A very common thing, and a very finally settled thing. Now, I've learned a lot about God since, but I've never been more certain about God since that time. I put it to you this way. If every human being I met told me, this is wrong, I would suspect my sanity, but I would not doubt God. I would simply say, I guess I'm paranoid on this subject. But as I checked over with my fellow men, I discovered that there's a lot of people know God in that sense.
Were you about 17 or 18
then, Bill? I was 17. I don't think it was anything particularly wonderful. I think it's a natural thing.
Bill, I'm still thinking about this phrase in the middle of page 1285, under God's gift. He does not alienate creation from himself.
When he says,
and the emphasis that modern theologians are giving that very thing.
Sure.
Called neo-orthodoxy. Barth and Reinhold Niebuhr.
When God sends personality out here, he doesn't kick it out. He encircuits it. I think this, when man worships God, and let's say that in a simpler, more understandable way. When man discovers his love for God, worship to me is synonymous with love. It is a special word which we use to express the love which a creature would have for a creator. If it isn't love, then I don't know anything about worship. This love seeks nothing, asks for nothing, simply is an outpouring of attitude. I think that goes over the personality circuit. I think this is how God knows his creatures love him. And this would apply to creatures who are not indwelt by thought adjusters, like an Adam, for example, or a seraphim, who are in the personality circuit, centering the Father. All moral creatures are in that circuit.
Bill,
should we go on with our inventory? Personality responds directly to other personality presence. We were discussing that the other day when we hypothesized Bud and Betty up on the second mansion world, and he's strolling down Glory and Hallelujah Boulevard, and she's fishing in one of the streams, and all of a sudden he stops and Betty looks up from her fishing. I'm sure that happens. I've got another theory. Have you ever been working all alone in your study, perhaps, and suddenly the hairs get stiff on the back of your neck and you have a feeling that you're not alone, and you look around and laugh because you are alone, but maybe you aren't. Only maybe your personality is registering the presence of another personality, only that other personality doesn't have skin on him, see? Now, I don't want to make a thing out of this, but I have a feeling that sometimes this feeling we get is for real. A personality did come near us. And the only equipment we've got that would register that is our own personality, and I think it registers. I think we tend to inhibit this. Let's say we know we're alone. This feeling tends to rise, and good common sense tells us there isn't anybody in the house, so we stifle it. That's a sophisticated response to that feeling. And we might as well be sophisticated, because if we get up and look, we aren't going to find it, you know? I think this is how we know upon the mansion world. This is a sense which is attached to personality when it is operating a life vehicle.
Bill, they state in the papers that many, many people have made the third circle.
Mm-hmm.
When I first read it, I thought nobody makes it hardly, and then I went on and found out that many make it, and they have a guardian seraphim.
Sure.
There's personality.
Sure, but if it was there all the time, I don't think they would sense the arrival.
Is it there all the time?
I don't know. Oh, yes, I think so. There's two of them there all the time. Because they got two cherubim associated with them who can stand in when one of the seraphim has to, you know, stop the gas up.
Go out for a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
Jim,
yes.
Don't you think that awareness of presence, possibly another personality, is probably some of the truth around which spiritual life
could be.
Ideas are
could be. Could be. I'll tell you. Pardon me, Bob.
We have a friend, and her experience is a very precious and beautiful thing to her. Or she looks at it as the present of a part of the kid or something. But I wondered if that was a feature that.
I wouldn't know. I wouldn't know. I had one experience along this line. On a train, crossing the vestibule between two Pullmans. And I can still remember reaching out for the doorknob. With my hand on the doorknob, I turned around to look at the guy who had passed me in this vestibule between the two cars. He had his hand on the doorknob and he was looking at me. And we both grinned at each other in a real silly way, you know, kind of embarrassed. We'd caught each other, staring at each other. And something had to be done about this, so one of us spoke, saying, do I know you? And then we exchanged names. I said, I'm Bill Sadler. He said, I'm Bill Harshey. And as little boys, we used to play together. I hadn't seen Bill Harshey since he was about 7 years of age. And he certainly didn't look like this rather broken-down character I was looking at then, you know. Now, why the dickens did we didn't look like we used to look. Why did we stop and look at each other? That's the only time that ever happened to me. But it happened once. Well, where are we done? 12. Personality is the one thing that can be added to spirit, thus illustrating the primacy of the Father in relation to the Son. Mind does not have to be added to spirit. And I'll add, thus illustrating the primacy of the Son in relation to the conjoint actor. Spirit is always conscious, minded in some way, because God, who is spirit, is always minded. But spirit is not necessarily personal, unless the Father bestows personality upon such a spirit. In other words, this goes back to our sequence story of the origin of deity. 13. Here's the quote I was looking for and couldn't find. It's right here. Personality may survive mortal death with identity in the surviving soul. The adjuster and the personality are changeless. The relationship between them, the soul, in the soul, is nothing but change, continuing evolution. And if this change, this growth, ceased, the soul would cease. The divinity of the adjuster is changeless. The identity of the personality is changeless. And the relationship between them is nothing but change.
This morning, discussing about the identity of the personality, how it survived.
Mm-hmm. And then number 14 intrigues me very much. Personality is uniquely conscious of time, and this is something other than the time perception of mind or spirit. You want to note down page 135? About the middle of the page, the text reads, there are three different levels of time cognizance. First, mind perceived time. Consciousness of sequence, motion, and a sense of duration. Now, I think that's what we talk about when we speak of time consciousness, number one. Second, spirit perceived time. Insight into motion Godward and the awareness of the motion of ascent to levels of increasing divinity. I think an adjuster has that kind of time consciousness. But that's not what we call time consciousness. And third, personality creates a unique time sense out of insight into reality, plus a consciousness of presence and an awareness of duration. Unspiritual animals know only the past and live in the present. Spirit-indwelt man has powers of prevision, insight. He may visualize the future. Only forward-looking and progressive attitudes are personally real. Static ethics and traditional morality is just slightly superanimal. Nor is stoicism a high order of self-realization. Ethics and morals become truly human when they are dynamic and progressive, alive with universe reality. Let's take another quote here. Page 1295. They're discussing time and eternity. In the evolutionary universes, eternity is temporal everlastingness. The everlasting now. The personality of the mortal creature may eternalize by self-identification with the indwelling spirit. Such a consecration of will is tantamount to the realization of eternity reality of purpose. This means that the purpose of the creature has become fixed with regard to the succession of moments, or the passage of time. Stated otherwise, the succession of moments will witness no change in creature purpose.